Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
David Sterrett is the editor-in-chief of the Quarterly Review of Film and Video, contributing writer at Cineast, film professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, Robin Hood Radio's very own critic. He joins us weekly. The films, The Five Bloods, The Ghost of Peter Sellers, and The Vast of Night. Over to you, CB.
Well, thanks very much, Jill. Hope you're doing okay this week. Yeah, we have three films here, which are all available through streaming, as is the fashion nowadays. And they're all pretty good movies. They're really quite interesting films. And I thought I would start off by talking about The Five Bloods, which is the new movie from the great Spike Lee. I say the great Spike Lee partly because, here comes a plug, I wrote a book on him just a few years ago called Spike Lee's America, available everywhere from Polity Press. And I am a great admirer of Spike Lee. That does not mean that Spike makes nothing but great films. In fact, in recent years, his record has been somewhat uneven. He spent some years, in earlier years, he has made some true masterpieces. Do the Right Thing, one of the great American films of all time. 25th Hour, other films too, which are very great films. But in recent years, some of his movies have been very minor, have not really amounted to much. Just not too long ago, he made a really sensational film called Black Klansman, very, very topical, dealing with all kinds of issues, which, if nothing else, are even more topical now than they were when he made the film just a handful of years ago. And now another movie, which is very topical and really a very major achievement by Spike Lee, The Five Bloods. So what we have now is a movie that actually goes back in time a bit. Well, actually, it doesn't go back in time. It goes back in time only in terms of part one aspect of its subject. It's about the Vietnam War. It takes place in the present day, but it deals very much with the legacy of the Vietnam War, in which something which has been dealt with by very, very few movies. What we have here are four veterans of the Vietnam War who, way back during the war, they were involved in a helicopter crash when their helicopter was carrying an enormous amount of gold bars, an enormous number of gold bars, which were being shipped into Vietnam to pay for some Vietnam cooperators with the United States. The helicopter crashed, and most of the crew members managed to escape. And what they did was they were able to take the gold and to bury it. However, after that, they were never able to find, because the war changed the terrain so much, they were never able to find where the gold was buried. So now, all these years later, they think they are now able to discover where the gold was buried. So these four guys, these four veterans of the Vietnam War, now aging African-American vets, they go back to the spot to try to find the helicopter. But just as important as finding the gold, they want to find the remains of a fifth guy who was with them and who they respected and had looked up to enormously. They want to find his remains and bring them back to the United States for a proper burial. So we have these four guys, and one of them, his grown son, a young man, they all go on this expedition, go into Vietnam, and all kinds of complications arise. One of them turns out to have a former lover who is still there, and he looks her up and so forth. But what we have here is a movie. Interestingly, the shape of the screen, as it's called in the trade, the aspect ratio changes frequently. And so we have parts of the film which are set back in the Vietnam days, and the screen has one particular shape. And then we have scenes which take place in the present day when the guys are there now looking for the helicopter crash and so forth, and the screen has another shape, etc. It's a long movie, about 2.5 hours long. It's pretty complicated in some respects, but it's always clear as a bell to follow it step by step. And we have here Spike Lee's extraordinary ability to create really compelling scenes and get spectacular performances. I'll just mention the main actors in the movie: Jonathan Majors, Clark Peters, Norm Lewis, Isaiah Whitlock Jr., and above all, Delroy Lindo, who gives a performance which is just an extraordinary performance in a very, very difficult part about a person who has really very powerful mental health issues. issues, which are stirred up again by this return to Vietnam. So terrific performances. A pretty compelling story, which I was especially pleased to see, because Spike Lee's last war movie, a film called Miracle at St. Anna, is one of his worst films, in my opinion. It was many years ago. But now I am very glad to see that he deals with war and combat, and especially with the legacy of war, very compellingly in this movie. And something which is really important about Spike Lee, and which I can never stress too much, his movie is so totally about the African-American experience and shows such compassionate understanding for African-American characters, but he also broadens it up beyond that. We see in this movie that there are good white people, there are good Vietnamese people, there are people from all different kinds of ethnic and national backgrounds who all deserve some attention in Spike Lee's eyes, and he is never a parochial filmmaker in that respect. However, this is very much about the movie, a movie about the African-American experience. I am not African-American, but as I can so often say of Spike's films, he drew me into this and helped me to understand and helped me to know things which I didn't understand or know before. And this is a very, very major and important film of this year. I hope it figures very strongly in whatever awards actually end up happening, despite the craziness of this year. In any case, The Five Bloods is a movie which everybody ought to make their business to go and see. Our second film for today, The Ghost of Peter Sellers, is really, really different. For one thing, its nationality is different. It is not an American film. It's a movie from Cyprus, of all places, but not exactly. It's a documentary, and it's made by Peter Medak, a pretty well-known and important filmmaker whose most famous movie is probably a film he made many years ago with Peter O'Toole called The Ruling Class. And here we have a documentary about something that took place in his own past. Many a long year ago, way back in the middle 1970s, Peter Medak set out to make a pirate comedy, a comedy about pirates, with the great comic actor Peter Sellers and the great comic Spike Milligan, who is most famous for his radio and television work. And Peter Medak, the director, set out with the great Peter Sellers and the great Spike Milligan to make this raucous comedy about pirates. And so they went off to Cyprus and other places to make this movie. And every single thing that could possibly go wrong went wrong, and not just wrong, but totally wrong. And that is what The Ghost of Peter Sellers is about. It is about Peter Medak trying to make this movie starring Peter Sellers and everything going wrong, partly because Peter Sellers was himself a difficult person, but partly because everything else went wrong. The people who were making this movie didn't really understand what they were getting into. For example, when they decided to make a pirate movie, which takes place largely on a pirate ship out in the water. And when you film out on the water, you have all kinds of difficulties that you don't have when you're filming on dry land. So the weather, the size of the waves, all this sort of thing caused them all kinds of difficulties that they just did not have the experience to cope with efficiently or effectively. And then again, Peter Sellers himself, he could be difficult, and he was very difficult at times in making this movie. At one point, Peter Sellers, who did have a very serious heart condition, which eventually killed him, faked a heart attack in order to get out of filming for a few days. This sort of thing, it was very, very bizarre, and the movie tells the story of this very entertainingly. Poor Peter Medak gets very emotional at times in this documentary because this was an extremely painful experience for him. I mean, he is now recalling, again, this is back in the 70s when all this took place, he is now recalling a very, very difficult experience that almost ended his career because this production turned into such a disaster for him. And he deals with various people in the course of this documentary, people who were there at the time, people who were involved in one way or another. They revisit some of the scenes of this disaster with him. And again, it's not just a totally comic experience, this documentary, because poor Peter Medak, who I met in an interview many years ago, he's a lovely fellow. He gets so emotional remembering some of the difficulties that they had because, again, this almost ended his career. Now, the funny thing is that this movie, this pirate movie that they were all making, was actually completed. It was actually made. It's not that they didn't get the thing done. It was called, by the way, Ghost in the Noonday Sun, but it was so bad that it never got released. So if you're wondering why you never saw Ghost in the Noonday Sun, is because the movie it wasn't just a movie that didn't turn out the way they hoped it would turn out. It was a movie that did turn out, it got completed, but it was so awful that it never got to movie theaters back in the 70s or anywhere else. So again, that's what The Ghost of Peter Sellers is about. It's a very entertaining documentary. It's a very poignant documentary. And if you have any feeling at all for the great, great, great Peter Sellers, because you see a lot of him in this movie, then this is definitely a film to see. It has some very entertaining footage, and again, some very poignant footage. It's one of the year's better documentaries so far. So our third movie today, continuing our theme, it's very different from the other two. The Vast of Night. This is a movie that was directed and co-written by a new filmmaker named Andrew Patterson, and I think a very, very talented filmmaker. And it is a science fiction film, and it is real pure science fiction in the old sense of that term. It's not so much a science fiction overlapping with horror film. It's really pure science fiction, but it takes place very much in recognizable settings in a world kind of like ours, even though it's a film that takes place in the 1950s, and it's very easy to relate to the characters and the various things that they go through, even though the story has some science fiction exoticism to it. So what we have here is a town in New Mexico where everybody is getting ready for a big high school basketball game. And among the people getting ready for this are a young disc jockey, not really disc jockey, he's a radio personality, whose name is Everett. And the whole first part of the movie deals with Everett getting ready to broadcast his play-by-play of the basketball game. And everybody in the town is getting ready for that. And people are scurrying about. But the very first thing we see in the movie is really a TV set. And the whole film, The Vast of Night, is set up as if it were some sort of a feature-length episode of a TV show way back in the 1950s. So the movie begins with a little TV screen showing flickery black and white images of the kind you used to see on your TV back in the 1950s. And then the screen broadens out and we have our real movie. But every once in a while we're reminded that the whole thing is meant to seem as if it were the sort of episode we might see in a 1950s science fiction TV show, maybe like The Twilight Zone, or maybe like, oh, one of the other science fiction theater, one of the shows that we're on. So what happens is we have the preparations for the big high school basketball game, and then something strange happens involving strange noises, strange sounds that are being heard. And Everett, the radio personality, decides that he wants to try to figure out what's going on. And he gets some help in this from a young woman in the town whose name is Faye, who is a switchboard operator. And so what we have are Everett, and then eventually a couple of people who he starts talking with on his radio show, and Faye, and some people she starts talking with through her telephone switchboard, trying to figure out what is going on with these strange noises that are coming into the area. In through the Vast of Night, we might say, or from the Vast of Night. Now, the thing about The Vast of Night, the movie, is that it is a very, very low-budget production. And it's a film which doesn't just compensate for its low-budgetness by doing all kinds of clever cinematic things. It makes a virtue of that low-budgetness. It's constantly kind of reminding us, almost on purpose, that we're watching a movie made with very slender resources, and the part of the fun of this movie is going to be to see what kinds of suspense and interest and drama the filmmaker can build, despite the lack of the kind of resources that we see in most science fiction movies nowadays, and in fact for a very long time now. Science fiction movies are films that tend to spread their special effects and so forth all over the screen. And here we have a movie with very little in the way of special effects, and that's part of the fun of watching it, is seeing the kind of momentum that the filmmakers can build, even though they're not working with the kinds of huge, spectacular resources that we have in the way of most science fiction movies nowadays. Now, one of the clever things that the filmmaker, Andrew Patterson, the director, does is to give us a lot of contrast. So the first part of the film, which is really about the getting ready for the basketball game and some things go wrong with the electricity in the area and stuff like that, the camera is moving. It is constantly steadily moving. And it gives, even though there's very little happening story-wise, it gives the movie a tremendous sense of dynamism. We're constantly roaming around. The screen is full of bustle and activity. The second scene, which brings us to Faye and her switchboard, is a long, long scene of one person sitting in one chair and talking for a long, long time. It's the opposite of the first scene. Tremendous contrast. And the rest of the movie proceeds in the same way. It's kind of back and forth. A lot of dynamism and then a lot of static quality, but it's never seen static because we're so interested in what the people are saying and the things that are emerging story-wise while we watch. So again, Andrew Patterson, a new filmmaker, shows himself to be an extremely clever filmmaker, able to take very slender resources and build them into something that really takes your attention and never lets it go for a second. And by the way, we do eventually start to figure out what these things are that are happening, where these strange sounds are coming from, what they might mean. There's a visit to an old woman who lives in another part of town who has some light to shed on this in another one of the film's long monologue. So it's an unconventional film, but it's a film which is getting a lot of buzz, and I think deservedly so, because it really shows what a young filmmaker can do with a good science fiction subject and a real grasp of what filmmaking can do without a whole lot of fanciness or special effects. So that is my extremely variegated story this week, Jill.
For which we thank you, and we appreciate the variegation. David Sterrett, Films in Focus, the films, Da Five Bloods, The Ghost of Peter Sellers, and The Vast of Night.